Thank you, Dr. Moore. It's an honor to be able to make this presentation today. And contrary to what many people have heard and believe, this book I'm writing on goodness, truth, and beauty is not my autobiography, but it is a philosophical and theological study of those issues. I want to speak this morning on God and beauty. Poet Wilfred Owen thought of becoming an ordained minister in the Church of England, but he left the church. And in the letter he gave to his vicar, he gave the reason why he was leaving. He said, to vicar, the Christian life affords no imagination, physical sensation, or aesthetic philosophy. And by this he meant that it had no place for beauty, whether in the arts or nature. This critique has been leveled against various areas of the Reformed tradition over the years, and in the evangelical world, at best, beauty is seen as an optional luxury, not integrally related to the faith in any respect. The power of beauty as a pointer towards transcendence is often overlooked and underestimated in the theological world. A famous philosopher was coming up with several arguments for the existence of God, and the shortest one that he listed was this: Mozart's music exists, therefore God exists. Actually, that was Al Plantinga who made that the shortest philosophical argument for the existence of God that I know of. And really, that's a very short way of making an argument from the existence of beauty to God. Virginia Woolf, well-known unbeliever, antagonistic towards the faith, Virginia Woolf was said to have said, Bach almost persuades me to be a Christian. And the most famous infidel and nihilist of them all, Friedrich Nietzsche, said of Bach's Passion of St. Matthew, he says this, one who has completely forgotten Christianity hears it truly as a gospel, as a good news in Bach. These quotes about Bach indicate, according to Richard Velesadu, a certain openness to faith as a genuine human possibility. If one can feel the human possibility of such an act of confidence in the face of death, even for a moment, even while more or less regretfully denying its truth, then one is at least faced with the further question, how is such an act possible? What is it in the human being, even in the unbeliever, that can not only intellectually acknowledge, but can existentially feel a fundamental positive stance towards existence, even in the face of death? In this sense, Bach's music, like all great religious music, performs a kind of apologetic function by evoking in the hearer a belief in the beautiful, a belief in life, and by raising thereby the question of grounds for such a belief. Of course, beauty can be made by unbelievers, but in the case of Bach, there was a determined intentionality about in his works. Christoph Wolff, an authoritative biographer of Bach, has said that the whole of Bach's musical corpus was one sustained philosophical argument for the existence of God. It's a very curious and interesting commentary on Bach from a secular world. What is beauty? Well, I want us to look at beauty philosophically as well as biblically. Now, for a Darwinian naturalist, for an atheist, beauty is simply an arbitrary word. The word beauty would simply be an arbitrary word to describe the process of something within an organism which helps increase that organism's chances of survival and reproduction. In other words, there's no such thing as beauty per se. There's no such thing as intrinsic beauty. Unless beauty is rooted in God's mind rather than our mind, beauty is simply no more than a statement of personal preferences. To say that something is beautiful means no more than I like it. I've often asked in my classes how many students believe in moral absolutes. And without exception, the classes here, everyone will say yes, they believe in moral absolutes. And then I'll ask the question, how many believe that there's such a thing as knowledge And there's such a thing as truth, and there's such a thing objectively truth that can be known and discovered and found out. And here again, in my classes here, without exception, people raise their hand and believe in objective knowledge, that there's such a thing as truth, objective truth, and knowledge, and that knowledge can be known. And then I ask a third question. How many people believe that beauty is in the eye of the beholder? Now, of course, the way I'm phrasing that question implies that beauty would be a subjective thing, a matter of taste or preference. So it's simply in the eye of the beholder. And not to my amazement and shock, because I've done it enough, many people raise their hand. So while we are not ethical relativists, and while we are not epistemological relativists, oftentimes in the evangelical world, we de facto find ourselves end up being aesthetic relativists. That beauty is a subjective kind of thing. It is simply something that's, quote, in the eye of the beholder, and there are no absolutes. So many evangelicals, even without any real reflection on the issue, like the culture at large, are aesthetic relativists. Of the three great transcendentals, goodness, truth, and beauty, beauty often finds itself left out as an absolute, even in the Christian world. The implications that follow from this are that you can never call anything beautiful and mean anything other than personal taste and preferences when you say it. In fact, at the end of the day, one ends up holding a position not unlike that of a naturalist. Darwinism is unable to give an account of beauty. The most that naturalistic Darwinism can attempt to account for in beauty is its powers of attraction in helping to facilitate the propagation of the species. One can certainly attempt to make an argument in certain areas, like this, like the attractiveness of a male peacock's feathers in attracting a peahen for reproductive purposes. However, there are great areas of what most people would call beauty that in no way can be construed for reproductive purposes, such as the various kinds of natural beauty that you would see in the snow-capped Rocky Mountains, or the setting of the sun on the horizon, or the waves of an ocean, of the waves of the ocean on the beach, or simply formation of clouds. Also, one can include certain man-made artifacts of beauty, like painting, sculpture, music, and various other examples from the visual and literary arts that ostensibly have no role whatsoever in the propagation of the species. One exception to that may be rock and roll music. I read Mick Jagger's biography, and he said before he was a rock and roll musician, he didn't have any dates. And after he was a famous rock and roll musician, he had more dates than he could handle. So maybe with that one proviso exception, there may be. I've read that oftentimes. I was reading it, in fact, yesterday. This is ad hoc. I was reading online yesterday about somebody who was just saying in passing, they went into rock and roll music because they wanted to pick up women easily. And so maybe there is a Darwinian explanation for that. And that may be the one exception to how to this the main point that I'm making. Anyway, the idea that beauty is not subjective can only be rejected by the Darwinian naturalists with great effort. Anthony O'Hare writes in his book Beyond Evolution, Oxford, 1977. He says this. He writes, in experiencing beauty, now this is a Darwinian naturalist, atheist. In experiencing beauty, we find ourselves to be in contact with a deeper reality than the everyday. Of course, one has to understand that in Darwinian naturalism, everything is the everyday. There is no thing other than the everyday, just naturalistic everyday. Here's what he does with this amazing observation. He goes on to say, art can seem revelatory, a strange thing for a Darwinian naturalist to say, just as it does seem to answer to objective standards. I want to read that line again. This is amazing coming from an atheistic Darwinian naturalist. Art can seem revelatory just as it does seem to answer to objective standards. It can seem to take us to the essence of reality, as if certain sensitivities in us beat in time with reality. It is as if our appreciation of things external to us are reflecting a deep and preconscious harmony between us and the world from which we spring. If this feeling is not simply an illusion, it may say something about the nature of reality itself as responsive to human desires. He goes on to say, but how could we think of an aesthetic justification of experience unless our aesthetic experience was sustained by a divine will revealed in the universe, and particularly in our experience of it as beautiful? It is precisely at this point that many or even most of us will draw back. Aesthetic experience seems to produce the harmony between us and the world that would have to point to a religious resolution were it not to be an illusion. But such a resolution is intellectually unsustainable. So aesthetic experience, however powerful, remains subjective and in its full articulation, illusory. This is a dilemma I cannot solve or tackle head on. I find this an amazing and extraordinary statement from a Darwinian philosophical naturalist. In response to this move by O'Hear, Peter Williams says, quote, to summarily dismiss the, quote, rigid religious resolution as, quote, intellectually unsustainable seems like an uncharitably offhanded failure to follow the evidence where it leads, a failure that also forces O'Hear to deny his first impression of beauty as being objective. This reminds me of the warning given to fellow scientists by Francis Crick of Crick and Watson fame. Crick was a Nobel Prize winner, molecular biologist who discovered DNA. And Crick told his fellow scientists, he says, now I realize that when you look at DNA, it gives the appearance of something that was designed by an intelligent cause. But he says, we have to remember, and we have to keep reminding ourselves that when we look at it, we have to tell ourselves, no, this cannot be the product of divine intelligent causation. Why? Well, because we have a religious commitment to philosophical naturalism. So he basically says, even though I know you're tempted, when you look at the DNA strand, that there is this overwhelming intuitive temptation to identify divine intelligence design in superintending that. But we just have to calm down and not get excited and remember that that can't be. Why can it not be? Because there's something in the empirical data that says it cannot be? No, it's the empirical data that moves us in that direction and that tempts you sorely to posit divine intelligence. But we have to remember we have this prior, and I'm putting the word religious commitment to philosophical naturalism. So in principle, we must give it naturalistic explanation. Well, basically, O'Hear is doing the same thing with aesthetics. He says there is this temptation, and he's reminding his fellow Darwinists, there's a temptation. It's a temptation when you see beauty. There is this powerful temptation to posit, number one, that it is not something that's illusory. Number two, that it's not something that's just purely subjective, that it's something that's normative and objective. And number three, that the inference that you draw from that it must be rooted in the divine mind. And then he says, but we got to draw back. We can't do that. Why? Because there's something in the data that forces him to do that? No. It's a prior commitment to a philosophy which excludes the divine. So, So what we have is an uncritical commitment to philosophical naturalism, and as a result of that, there's an intentionality to refuse to entertain the possibility in terms of both design, but also in this point, in terms of beauty, that there is a God. In recent times, even the materialist atheist has become critical of a purely materialistic view of art. The atheist and one-time Marxist art critic Peter Fuller wrote, quote, "For myself, I remain an incorrigible atheist. This is my proclamation of faith. Yet there is something about the experience of art itself which compels me to reintroduce the category of spiritual. More than that, I believe that given the ever-present absence of God, art in the gamut of aesthetic experience provides the sole remaining glimmer of transcendence. The best we can hope for is that surrogate for salvation, redemption through art." So basically, here's an atheist who says this is sort of the last hope of the notion of transcendence in art. And of course, he's going to naturalize even that. And so he wants redemption through art. And there's been a lot of people. Art as a surrogate for salvation is a hopelessly inadequate substitute. A major 20th century theologian has observed that the intelligentsia of the latter part of the 19th and early part of the 20th century despised traditional theology and valued the arts as the evaluation of the soul after the vanquishing of religion is the domain of the educated man. In and after the First World War, the belief in the arts as a substitute for religion broke down, although it does live in pockets even today. Art was not able, this theologian says, to open up the resources of power to meet the catastrophes of the 20th century. As is often the problem with arts as a pointer to transcendence, it sometimes confuses the pointer with the object to which the pointer is pointing. When the pointer becomes the end and not the means, it becomes an idol. And I would certainly concur that beauty is a pointer of transcendence, an indicator of transcendence, just like design, just like many other things are. But the problem that you often have in the arts is that the pointer of transcendence becomes the object of devotion rather than the pointer to transcendence. Augustine says, don't confuse the ring with marriage. He says, because the ring is a pointer, an indicator, symbolizing something else. Augustine says, don't confuse the aroma or the smell of a meal with the meal itself. Oftentimes, I'll take some students and we'll go out to Outback. And before I ever get into the building, you can smell those steaks grilling. And they deliberately put those things that carry all the smoke and the smell out of where they're grilling the steaks to where it comes out into the parking lot. So you went in just wanting a little 6-ounce, girly sirloin. Well, you get the 16-ounce prime rib. Why? Because you've been smelling that, and it's got you all worked up, and you want it. Now, I could trick some of my students sometime and just pull up in the parking lot, and we get out, and we just walk around the parking lot and smell it. I say, okay, boys. That's it. Now let's get back in the car. Hope you had a good sniff, good smell, because that's all you're getting. Augustine says, don't confuse the aroma or the smell for the meal. Now, obviously, we don't do that. But there is sometimes the danger of people confusing the pointers to transcendence with transcendence. The hints, the indicators of transcendence with transcendence himself. And so we need to keep this in mind. I've often been involved in various kinds of arts groups that made this confusion. At one place, I was as much as a layman could be involved in a Bach society, because I think Bach is the greatest musical theologian that ever lived. I wanted to be a part of it. Well, most of the people who were involved in it were secularists, and so it was, I always felt like they were just smelling around a restaurant. And, the aroma is incredible. I mean, there's no doubt about that. The aroma is incredible. But to take the pointer to transcendence as for transcendence itself is to stop short of the full meal. Now, while people often say that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, in other words, have a very relativistic view of beauty, and so therefore are aesthetic relativists, they don't always act consistently. If you pay careful attention to what they actually say and evidently believe, Inevitably, they will use language in such a way to give the impression that there is such a thing as objective beauty. In the same way, one can engage in a conversation with a moral or an epistemological relativist, and before long discover that those relativists seem to come down in absolutist terms on their own personal moral views or epistemological choices. The dissatisfaction people have with pure subjectivism and relativism is an indicator that the human being is a bearer of the imago Dei, that we're bearers of the image of God, and that if beauty is rooted in the mind and the nature and character of God, then we can understand the longing in the human heart for beauty. John Navona says that, quote, beauty has the subtle power of attracting or calling us. He goes on to make the observation that the Greeks recognized this when they named the beautiful ta kalon, and from the verb kaleo, which means to beckon or to call. True beauty is the attractiveness of whatever is truly good for us, he says. C.S. Lewis talked about the longing aroused by beauty in the desire for what he called our own far-off country. Lewis puts it this way, I feel a certain shyness. I am almost committing an indecency. I am trying to rip open the inconsolable secret in each of you, the secret that hurts so much that you take your revenge on it by calling it names like nostalgia and romanticism and adolescence. The secret also which pierces with such sweetness that when in very intimate conversation, the mention of it becomes imminent. We grow awkward and affect to laugh at ourselves, the secret we cannot hide and cannot tell, though we desire to do both. The argument for the existence of God based upon the fact of beauty is similar to Lewis's moral argument for the existence of God that you read in Mere Christianity. And it finds itself as a subspecies of the cosmological argument. Cosmological argument occurs in many different varieties. Centuries ago, Thomas Aquinas argued from the publicly observable fact of degrees of perfection to perfect being. And this is a variety of that argument. C.S. Lewis observed that we see people hold to the notion of morality seems to be something that is outside and distinct from us, both by the language we use as well as the kinds of behavior we engage in. For example, even the moral relativist is often very non-relativistic and adamant about saving the whales, protecting a woman's, quote, right to choose, or lowering the temperature of the planet. These issues are often couched in very normative language. The same can be said for beauty. While there may be shadings of opinions of what constitutes beauty, it does appear that there are commonalities in various cultures and places of what is truly bad in the sense of opposite of beauty. No one willingly desires to live in a trash dump for aesthetic purposes. They may for ministry purposes, but not for aesthetic purposes. In other places, things that people affirm as life-affirming, health-giving beauty. Therefore, the various degrees of perfections of beauty point us in the direction of a standard of beauty, whom we call God. As with all philosophical arguments for the existence of God, none of them bring us to a full-orbed, robust, biblical doctrine of God. For that, we need revelation. But as with all philosophical arguments for the existence of God, their limited benefit can point as pointers to transcendence and raise serious questions and debilitating doubts as to a naturalistic attempt to give an adequate account of reality. And scholars such as Richard Swinburne, F.R. Tennant, Peter Williams, Keith Ward have made powerful arguments for the existence of God based upon aesthetics. Now, I will say this. It is not one of the arguments that you hear most often, but powerful arguments have been made. Now, if for the biblical theist, if God has created all things, including us, then beauty must be defined in relation to God. Since God exists before the creation of the universe, his very being constitutes the standard for beauty. He is the standard. He cannot be judged by any standard of the created order. So the simple answer to the question, what then is the beauty of God, is beauty is what God is. At the end of each day of creation in the earlier chapters of Genesis, we read, God said it was good. In the Septuagint, we see the Greek word kalos used, which also has the meaning beautiful. As an artist puts himself into his work, God also, quote, put himself into his creation. Not in any pantheistic sense, but just in an artistic sense. You can detect who the author or a painter is of a work by studying the created product. So also, the pre-fallen universe was called good, beautiful, because in some sense it reflected the handiwork of its maker. Kalos means in Greek, quote, "It is the right, the fitting, the good, that which is appropriate to a being, that in virtue of which it possesses its integrity, its health, its security. Only insofar as it embraces all of this is Kalos also, by way of confirmation and proof, the beautiful." The early church fathers emphasized it, and it's been understood by many Christians down the ages that there's an integral connection between all that exists, its goodness and beauty. So they write of the splendor of the radiance of being, especially the radiance of God's being. Anglican Bishop Richard Harris said that in his search for truth, Augustine questioned all that he came across about the goal of his love. Augustine said, "What is the goal of my love?" He asked the earth and other finite objects what they knew. Each replied that it was not God. "And I said to all these things in my external environment, tell me that it was God, and tell me of this God who you are not. Tell me something about him." In other words, in asking the earth and the universe if they were God, they said, "No, we're not God." The confusion in Romans 1 that people have and what constitutes the ultimate of idolatry is confusing the creation with the creator. And so he's clarifying this. "And with a great voice, they cried out, 'He made us.' My question was the attention I gave to them, and their response was their beauty. Surely this beauty should be self-evident in all who are of sound mind," wrote Augustine. In short, it is the beauty of the created order which gives an answer to our questions about God, said Augustine. To use philosophical language, degrees of beauty in the created order points us to the ultimate beauty and the standard of all beauty, God himself. So in the same way that we deal with the question of goodness and truth, how is it not relativistic? Because it's rooted in a standard for goodness and truth. Ultimately, what is the basis for morality, for what's right and wrong? We have a standard in the very person of God. God's very nature is the good. That which corresponds to that is good. That which doesn't is not good. In the same way with truth, ultimately, God is the standard for truth. And so also in the same order, God is also the standard for beauty in his very person. So the obvious inference to draw from the notion that there is a normative and objective standard for beauty is, what are the standards for adjudicating whether something exhibits beauty or not? I'm inevitably asked this question when I raise the issue of normativeness and beauty. The first question that people ask, well, then how do you judge it? What are the standards? What are the criteria? That's a legitimate question. And it's one that naturally follows in the same way if you say there's moral absolutes or there's truth absolutes. The question is raised, well, how do you adjudicate it? Well, it's a legitimate answer and an answer that one should be prepared to answer. So I'm often asked this when I raise the issue of the normativism of beauty. The main reason for this, I think, is the brainwashing in our culture that, quote, beauty's in the eye of the beholder, that it's purely a matter of subjective taste. I think another reason is that in the back of our minds is the nagging question of what kinds of standards could one possibly suggest in such an apparently subjectivistic area of life. Also, people are used to easy soundbite answers and applications. And usually people just want a very quick soundbite answer. I want to make the observation that in two other areas where Christians have historically been non-relativist in ethics and epistemology, it's recognized and accepted that however difficult it may be to apply the standards of normativeness in these areas, it is a task that is doable, however much hard work it might entail. I'll give two examples, one from ethics and one from epistemology. As Christians, we believe in moral absolutes, but to work through what that will look like, for example, in the area of modern genetics, will take some concentrated and deliberate hard work. That's why at the seminary, we have an entire course in Christian ethics. because we recognize that soundbite ethical analysis is inadequate for the task of the day. Or let's look in the area of epistemology. We might rightly reject epistemological relativism of so much postmodernism, but this does not mean that the discovery of and building of a body of knowledge is a simplistic task. The answer to a difficult calculus problem is doable, but it won't necessarily be easy. The discovery of a cure to the modern medical ailments that plague mankind may well be doable, but it will still entail hard and sustained work. So we should also expect something similar in the area of aesthetics. Often people get impatient in the area of aesthetics. They just want a very quick soundbite answer. Well, on an intuitive level, I think people often have a sense of whether something is beautiful or not. But to be able to describe, to defend, to analyze that is a hard task. Take an example from medicine is a parallel example. You may be able to tell if somebody's not well. Let's say they come in and they look pale, or their skin looks jaundiced, and they have a fever, and you give your medical analysis. You're sick. Okay, well, so far so good, but you know, if you want a little more than that, maybe you should see a doctor. In other words, there are different levels of analysis, and different levels of analysis entails very hard work within the disciplines. And so I don't presume to make a technical or detailed a medical analysis if a student, you know, looks bad to me. I say, you know, go to the clinic, go see a doctor, something like that. So this is something to keep in mind, that it will entail hard work within various disciplines. To apply the standards of aesthetic judgment to a work of art can involve some hard work in explaining the judgment. In the same sense, there may be an intuitive sense that something is wrong with a work of art, but not to have the knowledge or tools to be able to make a proper diagnosis of exactly where it went wrong, what is the problem, or remedy. Of course, any true standards that are suggested will presuppose that there is such a thing as beauty in reality, and that it can be approximated or not to varying degrees. For aesthetic relativists, at the end of the day, bad art is simply art that they don't personally care for. And good art is art that they have a taste for. Sometime back, I had a student here who went on and took some courses in art and aesthetics at a secular university. Their professors were relativistic, both in ethics and epistemology and aesthetics. However, at least some of those professors did not like being in the position of an aesthetic relativist, because one of the implications of being a relativist is that they put themselves in a position to never be able to truly say of a piece of art that is truly good or that is bad. The most they could say, given their radical subjectivism, was, I like it, I don't like it. And how do they grade various students' art projects? By how much time was put into a piece? How many hours was put into a piece? By the students showing their knowledge of various styles and genres? That may be all well and good, but at the end of the day, they're still in a position where, in principle, they would be unable to say, this is good art or this is bad art. And, of course, in the art world today, there's a radical subjectivism that permeates it. With a few exceptions. And so it ends up just being just someone who likes it or who doesn't like it. This being said, what are standards for adjudicating beauty in the area of art? Now here again, these will be applied in different areas of art in different ways, depending on which whether you're talking about literary arts, literature, or whether you're talking about visual arts, painting, sculpture, or whether you're talking about music or whether you're talking about dance or other areas of the arts, the application of it is going to come with significant knowledge and activity in those disciplines. Francis Schaeffer, in his little booklet entitled Art in the Bible, which really pays to read again and again, lists four standard criteria: technical excellence, validity, intellectual content, that is the worldview that comes through, and the integration of content and vehicle. Schaeffer uses the medium of visual art of painting as an example of his first point of technical excellence. He says, "Here one considers the use of color, form, balance, the texture of the paint, the handling of the lines, the utility of the canvas, and so forth. In each of these, there can be various degrees of technical excellence. By recognizing technical excellence as an aspect of artwork, we're often able to say that while we do not agree with such and such of an artist's worldview, he's nonetheless a great artist technically." Schaeffer goes on to observe that an artist should be praised for his technical excellence, even if the worldview is defective. I often see this in literature, to use another area of the arts. For example, in Ursula Le Guin's children's stories, the Earthsea Trilogy, she writes brilliant children's stories from a pantheistic worldview. The worldview is dead wrong, but the technical side is excellent. The same can be said of movies. They may say the wrong thing beautifully. We're all familiar with this, and the alluring power of a morally bad movie is in the alluring power of its technical excellence. Schaeffer makes that observation about how powerful bad content is when it's packaged so beautifully. And the reverse is also true. You can have very good, true content. I've often heard friends comment about Christian films, and they use that technical word of aesthetics criticism called cheesy. You won't find that in a dictionary, but I think we know what it means. The content is wonderful, but it's cheesy, and it's so cheesy, and oftentimes it's unbelievable, and it's just out of touch with reality, and then, you know, their heart's in the right place, but just them and their mama are the only ones, the director and their mama's the only ones that's going to like it. And Schaeffer points out how important it is to have technical excellence with content. Now, I'm going to get to content in a moment, but I'm just making that point now, which really is obviously to a lot of people. And in working with people in our churches, we often see the allure of bad beliefs, bad doctrine, bad ideas made almost on an emotional level, almost kind of not believable intellectually, but the alluring power of it because of the technical excellence. This is seen in every area of the arts, whether it's music, whether it's film, particularly film, literature, and other areas. And we also feel that power. In fact, sometimes you'll be watching a movie and you'll say, "Wait a minute, I'm rooting for the wrong guy. He's a whoremonger and adulterer. He's the bad guy. What am I doing?" Yeah, I know he had a hard life, but you know, everybody has a hard life. So you feel that power because of the technical excellence. So in the area of technical excellence, there is beauty, and beauty has an alluring power. The second standard is of validity. What Schaeffer means by this is whether an artist is honest to himself and to his worldview, or whether he makes his art only for money or for the sake of being accepted or for propaganda purposes. We can think of the contemporary, Schaeffer says, we can think of the contemporary dramatist whose future is in the hands of critics of the passing moment. In drama, art, music, and cinema, we have a set of New York and London critics who can make or break the artist. How easy it is to play to the critic and not to take one's art as a series of expression of what the artist actually wants to do. Just a couple of days ago, I received, about 3 days ago now, a link at Facebook of a trailer of a new film out, which is a parody of the art world. The link was entitled Untitled Trailer. I thought that meant that the trailer didn't have a title, but I since learned I think that's going to be the title of the film, Untitled, I think. So I don't know for sure. Anyway, this is the description of the femme, and I'm reading the description exactly the way it was online, and the grammar's bad, and I didn't want to put a sick S-I-C every time. Or I'd be saying sick a lot, and you'd lose the train of thought, whatever there is. Anyway, this is the description of the femme at that trailer. A satire that pokes fun of the nuanced world of the New York contemporary art scene through a pair of competitive brothers, eclectic and self-important music composer Adrian and commercially successful painter Josh. I think there's a sentence in there. When Chelsea Art Gallerina and Josh's love interest Madeline attends Adrian's concert featuring the sounds of paper crumpling, glass breaking, and bucket kicking, that's the orchestra. Paper crumpling, glass breaking, and bucket kicking. It has a chain in it to add a little variety and interest to the sound of the bucket kicking. She commissions him for a gallery performance, and then, of course, a love affair ensues. Further complicating the situation is that Josh's highly commercial artwork, the financial backbone of the gallery, is sold to a corporate client discreetly out of the gallery's back room. So, you know, they're supposed to be artists, which are not concerned about, you know, money and da da da. It turns out, you know, the subplot, you know, they're selling out, you know, to corporate interests. From the trailer, it appears that the basis for the parody is a sustained example of a violation of this principle of validity. The third standard for making judgments in art, intellectual content, has to do with the worldview communicated by the work. And for us, this will often be the easiest part to adjudicate, because we're much more familiar with content and worldview kinds of ideas. A Christian judges the content of a worldview of an artist as they would of anyone, including the worldview of a teacher, a shop owner, a philosopher, or a potato farmer. What is called for here is basic worldview analysis of the worldview in question. One should pause and observe that the better that the art fares with regard to technicality and validity, the more alluring and powerful will be the temptation to skip the serious and hard work of worldview analysis. Destructive worldviews wrapped in bad art will have little power of persuasion. Every work of art has a message, even if that message is that there isn't any message. Nothing levitates when it comes to worldviews. Everyone stands somewhere. The last standard for making aesthetic judgments involves how well the artist has suited the vehicle to the message. For those artworks that are truly great, there's a correlation between the style and the content, between the vehicle and the message. The greatest fit art fits the vehicle that is being used to the worldview that's being presented. And Schaefer gives this example from T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. When Eliot published this in 1922, he became a hero to the modern poets because for the first time he dared to make the form of his poetry fit the nature of the world as he saw it, namely broken, unrelated, ruptured. What was that form? A collection of scattered fragments of language and images and allusions drawn seemingly haphazard from all manner of literature, philosophy, and religious writing from the ancients to the present. But the modern poets were pleased, for now they had a poetic form to fit the modern worldview of unrelatedness. Well, those are the four general criteria. They're applied with different degrees of accuracy and finesse to different areas of the arts, and by people who have talents and capabilities in those areas. I want to turn briefly to a passage in Psalms 27:4. There we can read David's ambition explicitly. He's very explicit about his ambition. Three things. One, he says, one thing I've asked of the Lord, but with three subpoints. It's like somebody says, I just have one question, but that there are three subpoints. One thing that I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. Now this infers goodness, morality, ethics. One of the things that is entailed in, quote, dwelling in the house of the Lord is ethically, morally conforming to that, quote, house. Secondly, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord, aesthetics. And then thirdly, to inquire into his temple. Well, when you inquire, you're asking, you're learning. It has to do with truth, with epistemology. So here we have all of the three great transcendentals, goodness, beauty, and truth. They are inseparable, and whatever truth or beauty we see, it has its origins in God. So also goodness, truth, and beauty are incarnate in Jesus Christ, his Son. We are created in God's image, so our soul is attracted to beauty. Think of this. Why do people have an attraction to beauty? Because we're created in the image of God. And God is beauty in the same way that he is goodness, that he is truth, the standard, the exemplar of it. In the created order, we see goodness, truth, and beauty in part, in approximate. The true light which lighteth every man that comes into the world always leads to the love of beauty. Where an adequate appreciation of goodness, truth, and beauty is lacking, a defective theology is likely to be found. Richard Harris says, all forms of art are in the business of truth, truth of eye and ear and mind. He says, true beauty is inseparable from the quest for truth. When the attempt to produce something beautiful is separated from truth, now listen to this, when the attempt to produce something beautiful is separated from truth, the result is sentimentality. Another quality that's necessary for great art is love. Truth without love leads to bitterness and cynicism. An artist who is always disdainful, who can only see the worst, who hates what they're working on, cannot produce great art. Since the time of Kant, the purpose of art has changed dramatically. Historically, the purpose of art was to create a thing of beauty. Well, if beauty becomes removed to the subjective realm and away from the objective realm, well, then there's no way to do that. There's no way, in principle, you can't do that. So post-Kant, the purpose of art is to use art as a vehicle for the artist's self-expression. And if you ask people today, you know, what's art about? Basically, most people will say, if they hadn't thought about it much, they're going to say, well, it's a vehicle for the self-expression of the artist. Well, that's post-Kantian. Pre-Kant, there was a job description for the artist, and it was create a thing of beauty. Post-Kantian, the job description for the artist is just do what you feel. Use it as a vehicle for the self-expression of your inner self. Now, these are very different goals for art. Create a thing of beauty or a vehicle for self-expression. One reason there's probably still much ugly art is because if the goal of art is not to create a thing of beauty, but rather to be a window into the human heart, well, then it's understandable because there's a lot of ugliness, lostness, and depravity in the human heart. Let's look further into Scripture. Man cannot behold beauty directly. No man can see God's face and live as Moses knew. We can see it as in a mirror dimly with our face covered, but it's there. Psalms 90:17. And let the beauty of the Lord God be upon us, and establish thou the work of our hands. God's the source of all beauty. Psalms 50:20. Out of Zion the perfection of beauty God hath shined. Psalm 96:6-9. Honor and majesty are before him, strength and beauty are in his sanctuary. O worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness. Fear before him all the earth. Since beauty is always related to God, it proceeds from him. Every good and perfect gift comes from above. So the task of the artist is to make visible the invisible, and the fact that all beauty has its origin in God, we rejoice in it no matter who's doing it. Why is beauty a thing of joy forever if loveliness increases, and will it never pass into nothingness? Because in some way all beauty is a reflection of the true glory and radiance of God and pointers to it. When goodness, truth, and beauty are combined, we have glory. Richard Harris says, when boundless goodness, total truth, and sublime beauty are combined in supreme degree, we have divine glory. God is in himself all glory in a sublime conjunction of beauty, truth, and love. It is the conviction of Christians that this glory is known in Jesus Christ. 1 Corinthians 2:8, He is the Lord of glory. Hebrews 1:3, He's the radiance of the glory of God in the exact imprint of His nature. And He upholds the universe by the word of His power. This glory is majestic. It brings wonder and awe and worship. Why does a sunset take away our breath? Why does a play or a song or a picture stop us in our tracks and knock the breath out of us? Because the fractured ray of God's glory has slipped through a fallen world for a moment, and we have a hint of God's glory. But we should not settle for the fractured ray that slips through this fallen world for a moment, but seek the fullness of God Himself. There is in the human heart an unquenchable longing for beauty, because God Himself is ultimately the beautiful one, and He made us desire Himself. Even the most perverted desire for beauty, for example, a desire to watch the athletic excellence of power and skill as gladiators slay one another in the arena, even this is a perverted remnant of a good yearning to God put within us to lure us into Himself, says Richard Harris. And we know that our desires and remnants of this urge for God, because everything less than God leaves us unsatisfied. He alone is true, all-satisfying object of beauty. Only one vision will totally satisfy our insatiable hearts, the glory of God. For that we were made and long for, whether we know it or not. All of the human longing for beauty are longings for this, the light of the people, for the beauty of Christ, who is the image of God. In March of 82, John Piper preached a sermon entitled, Jesus Christ is Precious Because We Yearn for Beauty. I highly recommend that. You can get it online at Desiring God. March 82, the sermon, Jesus Christ is Precious Because We Yearn for Beauty. He declares, whether you know it or not, all the longings of your life for beauty are longings for this, the light of the gospel of the beauty of Christ, who is the image of God. And Piper says, turn to Jesus as Lord and the veil will be lifted. The longing evoked by experiences of beauty is a deep desire for God Himself. What an awesome responsibility the artist has in the body of Christ to provoke beauty in an ugly world, to make visible the fractured invisible. We long to see beauty so that we may assume beauty, to be changed by beauty. This can happen partially through nature and human artifacts such as visual and performing arts, which are pointers to that ultimate metamorphosis when we will be changed into the likeness of Christ by repenting of all that is ugly in our life, seen, being cleansed, transformed, and ultimately transfigured to where we reflect God's radiance. Augustine again warns us not to confuse the pointer with the thing pointed to, with the wedding ring with the marriage, or the aroma of the smell with the actual meal. Dostoevsky made a staggering statement in The Brothers Karamazov. He says, beauty is the battlefield where God and Satan contend with each other for the hearts of men. Now that's an amazing statement. Beauty is the battlefield where God and Satan contend with each other for the hearts of men. It's curious that he said the battlefield was not in the area of epistemology. It wasn't in the area of truth. For that's because maybe he said that is because he knew Romans 1 and how men suppress the truth in unrighteousness. He also said that the battlefield for the hearts of men is not in the field of ethics, also because men are willfully evil. I don't know why he said the area for the hearts of men was in the area of beauty, except for the alluring power of beauty. The alluring power that it has to draw people both to goodness and to truth. So if you can cut off beauty, you may also cut off goodness and truth at the same time. I don't know. I will let better thinkers debate Dostoevsky's proposition, but at least his stating it, hopefully at least, puts it on our agenda. How many people have come to Christ through a lovingly beauty? 2 Corinthians 2:15 says we are the aroma of Christ. When you spread beauty, you're whetting people's appetites for something that will truly satisfy. I've read online that in bars, they give away free salty stuff, peanuts, popcorn, and they load it down with salt. Why? Why are they handing out free food? Because they want you to get thirsty. And then, of course, what are they going to do? They're going to satisfy in quotes with beer, which won't satisfy. One glass of water will take care of that. Well, there's not any water anywhere to be found there. But the beer you'll just keep drinking and drinking, or soft drink as well, by the way, doesn't satisfy it like water will. Well, our God incarnate, Jesus Christ, is the spring of living water. Come all who thirst, drink, and you will be satisfied. As human beings, we're beset by strange longings for we know not quite what. These longings evolved by experience of beauty is a deep desire for God Himself. It is a longing that we ourselves might become beauty, light, and glory through the glory of God shining in the face of Jesus. I close this with the final admonition in prayer Piper said in his sermon. He says, whether you know it or not, all the longings of your life for beauty are longings for this, the light of the gospel of the beauty of Christ, who is the image of God. Turn to Jesus as Lord. Open yourself to the Spirit of Christ, and the veil shall be lifted. And he prayed, O most glorious God, you're worthy of all our trust and obedience and adoration, yet I have sinned and see you so dimly. Now I turn to the living Lord Jesus Christ and invite your Spirit to fill my life. Remove the veil from my heart and grant me to behold your glory, and help me be changed from one degree of glory to another, in Jesus' name. Amen.